Bigger.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Wednesday, 29 January version of House Resources. Members present include Representative Kawasaki, Representative Tarr, Representative Hawker, Vice Chair Wilson, Co-Chair Sadler, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. I expect the other members to be along shortly. Sorry about the delay. The AO of the luncheon went long, and it's like herding cats to get everybody up the hill and get them into the meeting. So, with that understood, let's move on to the presentation. Once again, we have Commissioners Rodell and Balash. Today's topic being the Memorandum of Understanding between the state and TransCanada. So, Commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Commissioner Rodell and I, on December 13th, signed a Memorandum of Understanding with TransCanada, which I believe was posted online and made public at the same time as the Heads of Agreement about 2 weeks ago today. And what we want to do is walk the committee through how the MOU fits into the larger construct of the HOA and also explain a little bit about why we found this to be in the state's interest to pursue as a part of this overall project and undertaking. And so in order to put the MOU into context, I want to return members' attention to the HOA for just a couple of moments here. The project contemplated includes the gas treatment plant, the pipeline, and the liquefaction plant. And the HOA describes how all of the parties intend to work together to advance this project through development and ultimately into construction. The overall structure of the HOA contemplates an alignment of the state's tax and production tax and royalty interests in the gas with a corresponding stake in each of the project components, the GTP, the pipeline, and the LNG plant. Each of the parties will hold a position in each component commensurate with their respective interest. And so you see here, each party has the same share in each of the components. And that's where we start. Each party is free to set up their financing as they see fit, which is one of the real challenges that we've had as a state historically with these companies that we experienced under TAPS. And allows each entity to pursue their financing and partnerships as they see fit without interfering or complicating the business needs of the other parties.
At this time, I'd just like to make a quick note. We've been joined by Representative Olson, and also present in the audience is Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The MOU, then, is what covers the state's portion of the gas treatment plant and pipeline. We have sought to enter into an agreement with TransCanada for them to provide transportation services on the gas treatment plant and pipeline. The AGDC subsidiary that's contemplated in the HOA and the legislation would then hold the state's interest in the LNG plant. Part of the reason for that is the core competencies of TransCanada don't lend themselves to liquefaction. It's not a business that they are in. And it's also something that we think is going to be important for us to preserve either for ourselves or as part of our ultimate marketing efforts. pipeline is going to have 5 offtake points that will be identified by the administration in consultation with AGDC. We covered that previously on Monday. But this is the overall structure of the project and the commercial structure for the entities involved. So why TransCanada? TransCanada is a preeminent pipeline company in North America. They have a stellar reputation when it comes to delivering projects on time and on budget. When we consider the risks associated with a project that might go over budget, that would underscore the state's interest in seeing partners who have experience building projects of this sort and have a proven record of bringing them in, again, on budget and on time. We have an aligned interest with them to have an independent pipeline operating in this state and expanding on terms that are in Alaska's interest. The commercial terms underlying this arrangement provide economic benefits that we'll walk through in a couple of illustrative slides here with regard to the economics. They have experience building in discontinuous permafrost and mountainous areas. You can see from the map their position in Alberta in the Canadian Rockies is one that we will find and experience ourselves as we go from the North Slope down to Nikiski, passing through the Brooks Range and then the Alaska Range. And ultimately, the work that's been done in the past under our existing relationship in the AGIA license, the data that's been generated, the information that has been gathered, will be contributed to the AKLNG effort. And finally, we have a seamless transition out of the AGIA license and into this new commercial arrangement with all of the parties that does not impact the overall timeline. It allows for us to maintain momentum in the current year to allow for a full summer field season in 2014 that will in turn allow the pre-feed phase to be completed in 2015.
Question, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the seamless transition part, I just want to understand the relationship under the existing AGIA license, and is working with TransCanada necessary because that license is still in place, and you know, is that what's sort of forcing us, or just some of these things you're suggesting are related to the expertise of the company, but does it also have something to do with the license still being in place and us not being exposed to any lawsuit over damages?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, it's a combination of things. If we were going out cold and looking for a partner to participate in the pipeline with us, I'm convinced that TransCanada would be at the top of our list because of the reasons identified here. That's not to say that they would be a shoe-in. You never know. But the fact that they've been a partner for the last 6 years, that they are familiar with the conditions here, not only environmentally but commercially, and they are well acquainted with the interests of the state, suggests that they aren't going to have the same learning curve that some other pipeline company might have. Existing relationship, the existing commercial contractual relationship under the AGIA license is one that remains in place. We're going to wind down later this year, assuming we're successful in convincing the legislature to adopt enabling legislation, and it'll provide an orderly transition where we don't face the prospect or specter of potentially a messy divorce. under the AGIA statute, there's basically two paths to winding up the license, and this is the amicable one.
Commissioner, what kind of, you know, that whole aspect of a seamless transition? Currently, with the MOU, it is an amicable split from the AGIA process. But what's to say we couldn't simply have a divorce and go get another company or put it out for bid so that there was a little more competition in the selection of who would actually build this line? What kind of risks do you foresee if we were to if we were to follow that path instead of this one?
I think the first point would be that this is, in some ways, many ways, a continuation or evolution of the course we've been on as a state. While we consider preserving the AGIA license architecture, the AGIA framework, it's one that we ultimately decided to set aside, but not because we were dissatisfied with the partnership. Many of the terms that are contained in this MOU and attached Exhibit C are very similar to the terms that were provided in the AGIA application filed by TransCanada and improved over time in the course of their competition with the Denali project. And while it's not a direct parallel, we did see in 2010 a footing established as to what an appropriate split on the debt and equity might be, as well as the returns on that equity. The nature of an LNG project is different, however, and the risks associated to all the parties are different at an LNG project. So I think if we were to attempt to engage in a new round of competitive bidding, we would need to engage the legislature on what that framework would look like. We'd spend a few months here debating that. Then there would need to be the course of going through the solicitation process, the review process, and ultimately the award process. And those are all things that would take time. And certainly that's something that we could do, but we found that in the course of our negotiation with TransCanada this past fall that we did not see that as a necessary step, that we were able to achieve the things that we needed to here with the present arrangement.
How much time do you think that would take?
Well, we could harken back to the AGIA process itself. In 2007, the legislature adopted or passed the statute itself in early May. The request for applications went out in July. The original date for or deadline for those to come in was the end of October. It got pushed to the end of November. And by the time the review was done and the license awarded and adopted by the legislature, it was August of the following year. So in that case, it was an 18-month process, and when you consider the effective dates and when the license was actually signed in December of 2008, it was nearly 24 months.
Fair enough. Just a note, we've been joined by Representative Seaton about 10 minutes ago. All right, thanks, Commissioner.
AGIA question.
Okay, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just since we're talking about AGIA, I wasn't sure if it was going to be brought up, but can you tell me, I mean, I know that we've spent, I don't know how much under the AGIA license, maybe short of $300 million or so.
A little more.
And I guess, when are we as a legislative body going to be able to see the product from that $300 million spend? And in what format?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, there's a number of things that were done with the funds spent by TransCanada and its partners in the APP. The information that was gathered and generated fed into a series of resource reports, draft resource reports that were filed with the FERC and sent out to agencies for initial review and comment. That all occurred in 2012, I believe. And as far as all of that data goes, everything that was generated under the license, we, under the terms of the statute, have the option to buy every bit of it out at a cost of approximately $130 million. At this time, we're not recommending that the state exercise that option, in part because TransCanada and its partners in the APP are both expected to be partners in AKLNG. They're going to contribute the information gathered to AKLNG and avoid a duplication of effort and cost for this project that we're talking about today.
Okay, please continue, Commissioner.
So, MOUs. We pulled from Investopedia this reference to what a typical MOU is. And in this case, the MOU outlines the terms of our relationship with TransCanada and the midstream components of the project. Again, that's the treatment plant and the pipelines, as well as the transmission lines that come into the treatment plant. One thing that's very important, however, is that the terms identified, particularly in the exhibits, are terms that Commissioner Rodell and I cannot enter into with any force of law or binding commitment. And it spells out specifically and explicitly that the MOU is not binding until the legislature enacts the enabling legislation. As we seek the legislature's permission and authority to enter into the various contracts associated with this project, our intent, both with the MOU and the HOA, is to provide a window into what the agreements will look like coming out on the other end before 2015. And the idea, frankly, is just to make sure that the public legislators know what the party's intent is, so that when we do return to the public and the legislature in the fall of 2015, you'll have some measure against which to evaluate the product. You'll know what it is we're bringing to you, and you'll be able to evaluate it against that.
Representative Seaton, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the MOU, the enabling legislation, which is going to make that legally enforceable terms, is the enabling legislation that you're wanting to go into place this legislative session?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's correct.
And follow-up. And so at that point in time, then the terms of the MOU become legally binding and give us liabilities if things fall apart? Is that what we're looking at?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the MOU is an agreement to agree. The term sheet in Exhibit B, the term sheet in Exhibit C, are for agreements that will be struck later this year if the enabling legislation passes. And those agreements will contain the terms in these two exhibits. And in terms of the exposure to the state in that regard, we will be potentially exposed to development costs incurred on the part of TransCanada during the pre-FEED phase. And we'll get into the cash associated here in just a few slides, but basically we're not going to be required to meet the cash calls of the project in this initial phase. During the development phase, TransCanada will be incurring those cash calls and obligations. When we will start paying TransCanada in a success case is when the pipeline goes into service. And that's one of the benefits of having a partnership in the midstream that we've outlined here with TC. And potentially, we may see additional partnership opportunities on the liquefaction. But we don't have any that are contemplated specifically at this time.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. And just along the same line of questioning, I'm just trying to understand exactly how the MOU works into the House bill that we haven't had a chance to review. So if we don't pass House Bill 77, this will expire in the middle of the summer.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I would be thrilled if the legislature passes House Bill 77, but I think you mean 277.
Sorry.
Nice, Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the authority to enter into the agreements contemplated here is what we're requesting be provided in House Bill 277. So if that legislation were to not pass, then yes, this MOU has a shelf life.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
So what happens in the event that there's amendments to House Bill 277 that the parties have not yet agreed to?
I would, if members who have a copy of the MOU in front of them, I would call your attention to 2.1D. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just read that into the record. The parties agree to support the approval of the operative terms in the enabling legislation, but acknowledge that the enabling legislation may include authorizations or conditions that vary from or conflict with the operative terms. In such event, and if parties agree to accept the enabling legislation, then the transition agreements will reflect the enabling legislation terms and conditions, notwithstanding the parties' acknowledgement in 2.1C above.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Could we get a translation of that, Mr. Chairman? No. Mr. Chairman, go ahead, Representative. So, Deputy Commissioner, does that mean that if we pass the legislation, we're giving the ability to modify the terms and that we're agreeing to those terms even though we don't know what those terms will be and that they can be in conflict with the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding that we have passed?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think it'll be easier to talk about that in the context of the legislation when we get to that point in the process. But if it's okay to speak just generally to the bill, the authority that we're asking is not specific to these terms. It's asking for general authority and general applicability. We intend to enter into agreements with that authority that reflect the terms contained in this MOU and the exhibits. If that authority that we're requesting is somehow limited or conditioned by the bodies, then what this section is saying is that if we're both prepared to continue to move forward under those limitations or conditions, that we will do so. I expect that all of the parties are going to engage in the legislative process here, that as you review the bills, if changes are made, you'll gather testimony, you'll have a sense of the relative appetite on each party's part to accept those conditions or further limitations.
And just
hello, Purpose.
And the parties are not the legislature. The parties are the state negotiating ability that the administration, TransCanada, and the three majors.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. We're going to be short of time here, so let's keep going.
So the timeline that is contemplated in the MOU and that fits in with the HOA is, in supposing a success case, in April, the enabling legislation passes. Within 90 days, we would execute the precedent agreement, as well as the equity option agreement in Exhibit B. And that precedent agreement would govern the pre-feed period here with regard to development costs and activities associated therein. As we move into 2015, the more specific and more binding firm transportation service agreement would be developed. And that is the contract that would come back to the public and legislature for review and approval in 2015. And the expectation is that it would be a part of the larger body of other contracts necessary to enable the project to move forward and move into the FEED stage. In that same time period, we have an option to call back a portion of our equity in the midstream. That option is available until December 31st of 2015 or the entry into FEED, whichever occurs first.
Question, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I just missed that last part. So you, the equity option is available until December 15th, 2015, or?
The entry into FEED.
Got it.
Representative Sutter?
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Can you describe what all is included in the Firm Transportation Services Agreement?
Through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, that's a mouthful. The Firm Transportation Service Agreement is the binding contract between a transporter and a shipper for service on the pipeline. It gives us it would give the shipper a contractual right to capacity in the pipe to move gas under the terms contained in the contract. Now, some of the key commercial terms there we'll talk about more specifically here, but it goes to the tolling structure, the capital structure for rate making, goes to some of the conditions around interruptions or delays in service, any number of things. And those terms are not necessarily standard, depending upon the pipeline you're describing or talking about. There are certain features of such agreements that vary from place to place or regulatory regime to regulatory regime. So, but it is in fact a contract between two parties. So, beyond the MOU, we have the two exhibits, Exhibit B and Exhibit C. And Exhibit B lays out an equity callback option that we have negotiated as part of this. If the state's overall position in the project is 25%, TransCanada would be at 25% in the GTP, the pipeline, and the AGDC subsidiary would be in the LNG plant at 25%. However, we wish to exercise our option, we could claw back 40% of that midstream interest. And it's contemplated in the diagram shown here that we would rely on the AGDC subsidiary being established in the legislation to hold that equity interest. And so then there would be a split between AGDC subsidiary and TC. Again, using the 25% example, TC would be at 15 and AGDCS at 10, totaling 25. Part of the reason that we wanted to have this option is the potential revenue opportunity associated with it. When we go through a couple of the slides here further in the deck, you'll see that revenue opportunity, while real and substantial, comes at a cost. It comes at a cost of capital that the state very likely would have to bear. And so it's not necessarily a foregone conclusion that we'll want to do that. It's going to be part of the considerations we all undertake here in the next 18 to 24 months.
President Kawasaki.
Just a brief question on the 40% partnership and what does that physically mean? Like, what amount of cash and cash flow would that mean for the state to be obligated?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the GTP and pipeline together, under our estimates, total about $22 billion. If we're at 25% in the project, then we're looking at a total share that arrives at somewhere around $5.75 billion. And that's for both the GTP and the pipeline. If we would then take responsibility for 40% of that, working back through the math, we're looking at a little more than $2 billion. The next component of the MOU is Exhibit C. And Exhibit C is the term sheet for the midstream transportation services. And these are the typical terms you would see in a PA and ultimately a firm transportation service agreement to follow. And I want to call out just a couple of those key terms and benefits that accrue to the state as a consequence of this particular structure. First, we've got a very favorable debt-to-equity ratio. On the second anniversary of in-service, the tariffs that we would be charged would be calculated on a 75-25 basis. We'll show on the slides that follow that the amount of leverage in your capital structure has tremendous power in driving down the tariff. And, you know, if you recall from Monday's conversation, we spent a little bit of time talking about how important it is to the state to keep tariffs low. That for us, that results in a higher wellhead value, but also lowers the hurdle to additional parties to bring in additional gas beyond Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. So fundamentally, our interest is to keep those tariffs low, even if we are one of the owners in said pipeline. Those lower tariffs improve our cash flows overall, and that shows up not only on the royalty side but also on the production tax side. The second major point here is the item I mentioned before, the cash calls, the state's exposure to cash calls during the development period. With TransCanada in the equity position that we've outlined, they will be responsible for meeting those cash calls during a development period. We will not, unless we exercise our equity option. They'll be responsible for those cash calls and obligations all the way through the point of in-service. In other words, we don't pay until gas flows, until the gas starts to move. Point number three, and this is where the Department of Revenue gets to be a much more important player in the calculus. When you take into consideration the opportunity cost on our capital, by relying on TransCanada to come in and use their cash and their balance sheet, our NPV overall is improved. And that's something that we think is going to become very important as we consider the next 10 years and the cash requirements of the state here. It's something that we're going to need to pay attention to as we manage our way through these next several years. The fourth point is one that I think is a continuation of the issues and priorities identified in the AGEA structure, namely that we need a favorable expansion policy to govern the project. And in this particular case, we have a commitment by TC to structure future expansions on a 70-30 basis. Again, providing those low tariffs for expansion shippers. And then five, of course, is getting gas to Alaskans, providing at least five offtake points, and providing distance-sensitive rates. We've got three zones identified in the term sheet, one in Nanana, one at Big Lake, and one at the LNG plant itself. What that means, simply, is that for our largest communities in South Central, they will not pay the same tariff to get the gas connected into the NSTAR system as the export volumes that go all the way to the plant. As well, the offtake at points starting Nanana and above will pay less in transportation costs to come off of the main line in that part of the state. And we've got an illustration of what that looks like with our current understanding of the project costs and economics.
Yeah, Representative Seaton on Saturday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Trying to understand under the structure that we're proposing how the tariff influences the royalty and production tax. I thought that we wouldn't have any royalty, wouldn't have any production tax impacts because we were taking gas in kind, and that split is going to be determined up front. So am I misunderstanding how there would be influence on production tax and royalty on the tariff?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think there may be a little bit of confusion here, and I'll be happy to explain. And maybe talking about oil is going to help illustrate the example. When we take in kind for oil on the North Slope, we do so with a price that's pegged to the ANS West Coast, but then subtracts a transportation differential. So you get to a wellhead value for that oil. And the same is true here when we're talking about gas. There's going to be a price achieved for the sale of the LNG, but you're going to have to work your way back through the chain of infrastructure to arrive at a wellhead value for that royalty and production tax.
Follow-up, proceed.
I thought the structure of this is that we're taking our value, both our royalty and our tax liability, in kind. So that we're taking that as a percentage of gas and not a percentage of value. So I'm trying to figure out how the tariff is going to reduce our amount of in-kind gas.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's not going to reduce the amount of gas that we get, but it is going to impact the value we ultimately receive for our share of the gas when it's sold in market. We're going to be taking our gas at the slope, and then we are going to be responsible for moving it through the infrastructure. And so we're going to need to have capacity in the GTP, the pipeline, and the liquefaction plant. And all of those costs are still going to have to be accounted for. The benefit of this structure is that we are going to be in control of the decisions that affect those charges, those tolls. We are going to be making the decisions about the relative debt-to-equity ratios and the financing costs associated with it, rather than relying on the decisions made by the other three parties.
And just following up, you know, one of the big problems that we've had since we talked about oil was the disputes of the producers shifting costs to the downstream or to the midstream, so that that lowered the value, and we were collecting the production tax, and so that caused a loss to the state. I was under the impression that under this procedure, where we are taking both royalty and our production tax in kind as a split of the actual raw product, that we avoided those considerations between the producers and us as far as shifting or desiring to shift where you take your profit. So if I'm misunderstanding that, maybe what or maybe at some point we can do a flow chart and show me how that works, as well as other people.
So we'll be happy to do that.
Yeah, I'm not wanting to hold it up, but it's a critical element if we're not avoiding that same dispute, but we won't have control over the tariff setting necessarily, depending upon how the contracts are.
Mr. Chairman, I think the next slide actually will help explain this particular point, and we'll have to think about it in the context of the overall structure.
Okay, Rep. Sauter is going to hold his question. On with the presentation.
Okay. So what we're showing here on slide 10 is how a favorable debt-to-equity ratio affects the tariff. And as you move from left to right towards the middle, you see changes in that debt-to-equity ratio. And as you move from continuing further from left to right in the middle, you see changes in the ROE. So, following along here from the far left, at 55% debt, 45% equity, you see that you arrive with the same project costs involved here. The project costs are the same in every one of these assumptions and scenarios. The same costs, but financed in different ways, results in higher or lower tariffs. And so for us, we prefer to see a higher percentage of debt because that drives the overall tariff down. And for some of our partners, they are less concerned about the tariff, and they're injecting and using their own equity for their portion of the project. And that's where we've had the tussles over TEPS tariffs in the past, among other things. And it's been part of the struggle over gas, is how are we going to finance this major piece of infrastructure, and what are the resulting tariffs going to be? And so when we examined the overall structure here, where the state, Conoco, BP, and Exxon are the four providers of gas, we all have somewhat different views as to the appropriate financing structure that will be employed in this project. What the heads of agreement is going to allow is for each party to pursue their financing separately and independently. And so if, for example, BP wants to go with a 55-45 split because that's what works for them and gets their board approval, that's fine. They can go with a 464 tariff. For us, we want to see something considerably lower. And going to the 75-25 split drops that tariff by more than 60 cents. So the freedom of this structure allows us to pursue that higher leverage for the components that we're invested in or shipping on.
Commissioner, how does the, obviously this would be the debt equity ratio on our share or the combined state TransCanada share of the pipe. About the other partners, I mean, we don't have any control on the debt equity ratios that they're going to use, yet that is also going to contribute into the calculation of the tariff. So how much predictability do we really have here?
Mr. Chairman, what's contemplated here is that each party will be responsible for their own capacity and have their own tariff. So the tariff charged by Exxon for Exxon Gas doesn't affect us in tax and royalty terms. By aligning our interest in the infrastructure with our interest in the gas, we're free to set up financing on terms that we want or with partners who are prepared to do it on terms that serve our interest.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay.
Thank you. If I'm reading this right, why stop the 75-25 debt to equity if the lower tariff is at 95% debt?
Through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, that's where the banks get involved. And when you're talking about a major financing, major undertaking like this, the amount of skin you have in the game really matters to the people who are lending billions of dollars. Commissioner Rodell knows much more about the ins and outs of that process.
So this is not a zero down house purchase.
We're not buying a Toyota.
Can't get a VA loan on a pipeline. That's right. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I'm just trying to figure out. So it's contemplated that if there's initially spare capacity and everybody's got a quarter of that spare capacity, then the parties are going to be paying the tariff to TransCanada. Is that correct? Or how is this tariff being assessed? And who gets it?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is a scenario that we don't have prepared to show you here in these slides, but we'd be happy to show you the mechanics of that. But what is contemplated in the heads of agreement in Article 6 and Appendix A is that any one of the parties can expand any component in the project so long as they do so at their sole risk. In other words, if BP wants to expand and nobody else wants to, then BP can do it, but they have to pay for the cost of the compressor station involved. And that means that for us, we are unaffected. Our tariff doesn't go up, it doesn't go down. For third parties, it's expected that we, the state, and our portion of the project are going to be providing service for third parties who show up and want to pay for service. And exactly how we structure that is something that we talk about here in Exhibit C. TransCanada is prepared to undertake those expansions on a 70-30 basis.
Quick follow-up, Ripsey. Quick follow-up was, I was under the impression that if there was expansion rates, everybody would benefit if rates were going down. But what I'm hearing you say is rates won't go down because they're solely, whoever expands is solely responsible, and so that there would not be a general lowering of tariffs among all the parties because whoever does the expansion is going to be solely responsible for that, and so they would essentially receive those benefits. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, or through the chair, Representative Seaton, at risk of getting really down into the weeds, there are scenarios contemplated in Appendix A where a reallocation of capital costs is undertaken as the equity ownership is reallocated as well.
Mr. Chairman, that can be at a future time, but it's something I think we need to investigate because we've been under this general impression that as expansion takes place, everybody's tariffs would go down, but if it costs more than only the new players would pay, there wasn't that 100% in rolled in rates or anything like that. So appreciate that, Ms.
Okay, Representative Wilson, then we need to keep.
I
good?
My
okay,
turn.
Let's keep going.
So, Mr. Chairman, just on that point, the fight over incremental versus rolled-in pricing is one of the things that befuddled us and was a real challenge to breaking through on an overall deal. And by going on this particular road and allowing each party to set their financing and associated tariffs as they see fit and allowing expansions to happen on a so-risk basis, we've kind of maneuvered around that struggle in a way that we're satisfied with.
Stay tuned. More news 11, right? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is slide 11, and continuing on the favorable debt-to-equity ratio, just another way to illustrate the benefits for Alaska and our tax and royalty revenues. When you consider the debt-to-equity ratio and the ROE, what we found as we engaged in the negotiation with TransCanada, you know, we looked at that 12% ROE and really thought, you know, we should try and push that down a little bit. And the tug and pull in the negotiation was happy to move down on the ROE, but then we want to revisit the debt to equity structure. And what we found is the debt-to-equity structure is far more powerful in reducing our tariffs and increasing our value. And that's what you see reflected here. In terms of the total cash...
Question,
Mr. Commissioner, I confess the chart puzzles me a little bit. I understand the blue side. This is just two different dynamics being expressed on the same chart. The return on equity is, and that's determined by regulation or determined by market conditions. Is that in whose control, and why we need to see that breakout there?
Through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, the ROE is a component of the contract, and sometimes those contracts are purely commercial, purely civil, and agreed to by the two parties. In other times, in other cases, depending on the regulatory regime, that ROE is reviewed and approved by a rate-making body.
So set by contract, so that's a continuum we can choose.
Right. And so the lower the return on equity, the higher the netback, the higher the associated NPV.
So this is two different levers, two different dials.
That's correct. And we're just showing the magnitude of the move with each of those levers.
It threw me that they were both in the same chart. I'm thinking, is there some interplay between those two factors? And I think I'm hearing you saying no.
No.
Thanks. Good.
In slide 12, we're taking a look at the capital that would have to be provided, and that capital is going to be provided for the various components of the project, the GTP, the pipeline, the liquefaction. And that capital is going to be a combination of equity, cash, and debt, as we would expect it. And so what you see is the state's interest rolled up here, 20 and 25% equity options, because that's those are the boundaries that we've agreed to here in the HOA. So if you start on the far left, you assume no TransCanada participation. The state would need to come up with approximately $9.1 billion for the 20% option and $11.4 billion for the 25% option. And you can see the breakdown between the equity and debt components of that CapEx. As you move to the middle pair of numbers, you see what things look like from a state capital perspective. If TransCanada owns the GTP and the pipeline in our shoes. And what you see what in the figures remaining are the numbers associated with the liquefaction solely. And so you see the equity and debt combinations there, $4.6 to $5.8 billion. As you move to the far right, and that's that third pair of numbers, you see what happens if we exercise our equity callback, the 40% buyback, and the requirement for us to meet additional CapEx requirements during project development go up. And so what we're attempting to illustrate here is the total CapEx that we may have to come up with to fund our share of the infrastructure while it is being developed and constructed.
Okay, Representative Johnson has a question.
Has there been an analysis? I mean, we could go out and bond for $11.4 billion at 3%, 2%. I mean, what's the rate?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, for the record, Angela Rodell, Commissioner of Revenue. I think that's not a good starting point to assume that we can go out and sell $11 billion of debt at a 3% rate, because first of all, this project's not going to qualify for tax exemption. And that's assuming a tax exempt rate. And, you know, I don't want to sit here and promise that we can raise $11 billion today in this market at especially those levels. So I think I want to, you know, I want to counter that premise before we.
Yeah, and I guess what I want to look at, Mr. Chairman, if I could, is I guess in theory we could write that check.
Mm-hmm.
So bonding off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And why wouldn't, has anyone done an analysis on the long-term returns? If we can get 12% on our money, which is the return on investment, why would it not behoove us, and has anyone done the analysis over a 15 or 20 year period? And I understand mm-hmm. the risk, I understand what we're doing, and I'll even go so far as to call it a gamble.
Mm-hmm.
But if we get to that point, I mean, we're going to have some pretty good information to make that wager.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, has anyone done an analysis over the life of this as a return at 12% if we do it on our own?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, we have done some of that analysis, and we'll get to it in a couple of slides. And one of the ways that we had it looked at is, you're absolutely right, we could take and write that check today and get a potential for 12% ROE on it, like we saw here, recognize that that is not money then available to do other things within the state, that this pipeline is not expected to actually start delivering revenue until 2022, so it'd be a 10-year tie-up of that money. And so is there a way that we can account for those cash calls today and keep that money for ourselves invested and using it for the purposes and basically leverage our balance sheet? And that's what you'll see. That analysis was done. You'll see that in a couple of slides.
And I appreciate that, and I'm looking forward to that. And I'm trying to make a determination of, you know, who we partner with and what's the best thing for the state. You know, and you were saying the other night, and I think maybe I'm getting construction and operation mixed up. When we when this pipeline is built, we're going to be on the hook for 25% or 20% of the volume, and we're on the hook for that. I mean, that's part of the open season, that's part of all that. And how does, can we contractually say TransCanada is on the hook for their portion of it? I mean, we're bidding the gas; it's our gas. I mean, do we transfer the gas so that they've got the liability, so that they can write the checks that we've been talking about? What's the process? I don't understand the process of, we're on the hook for the volume if it goes down. You know, if something happens to the pipeline, we can't do delivery, we have to make that up. Does TransCanada step up and do that? Do we have to do that? Where does the liability begin and end? Is it only all about cash flow? Are we sharing liability? Mm-hmm. Are we sharing responsibility? Are we sharing accountability? And if that's the case, does any company have the balance sheet to put up with a 6-month or a 3-month failure of this pipeline to make that up and go out and buy that on the spot market? I mean, are we looking at, we're on the hook, it's us. TransCanada's got bankruptcy protections, all the other stuff that we don't have. So help me understand how, I mean, I understand the money up front, I understand the cash flow, but I'm also looking at, you know, when we start getting 12% returns 25 and 30 years from now, that the next generation of Alaskan is not on the hook for a failure, an earthquake, any number of things that keep us from being able to fulfill these long-term contracts that have financed this pipeline. Who's on the hook? You and I or TransCanada?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, exactly how the obligations are carried will be the product of the negotiations not only between ourselves and TransCanada, but ourselves and the producers and ourselves and the buyers of the LNG. As contemplated here, without knowing the terms of the SPAs for the LNG itself, what you can expect is that the contract we sign with TransCanada is going to be used by TransCanada as a basis for going out and financing their share of this project. And the daily reservation charges that we're going to be on the hook for, absent some other mitigation measure, are going to be substantial. They're going to be measured in, you know, a couple of $1 million a day. What we will do to mitigate a risk that you're describing, such as an earthquake or some other disruption, is going to be one of the things that we have to absolutely undertake to provide in this next period of development. In some cases, companies, entities, acquire insurance, catastrophic insurance even, for those kinds of things. And in terms of satisfying the obligations to buyers to continue to find gas and provide it, you typically have force majeure clauses in your SPA. So, you know, those kinds of things will be part of the marketing arrangements and marketing engagements that we undertake in the next 18 months, because that's a component of all this that we don't yet have a firm handle on. We don't know yet what the buyers are prepared to accept in the way of liability. I'd also point out that we don't yet have any partners identified for the liquefaction. It is not unusual for buyers to want to own a piece of the liquefaction, and if that is something that we encounter in the marketplace, we'd certainly want to entertain that, but we'd also want to see what part of our obligation to TransCanada they're prepared to take on as well. In thinking about this total approach to project ownership or equity participation in this endeavor, we did not come at this particular set of solutions with a desire to invest state capital in a pipeline project or an LNG project. The folks in the Division of Treasury are already doing that day in, day out. You know, they can invest in LNG projects all over the world. That's not what we're trying to do here. What we're trying to do is arrive at a point where we can see the resource monetized and potentially set up arrangements that satisfy us and our needs and result in cash flow to the state. How much risk we want to take is probably going to impact the amount of cash we get out of the resource. And one of the struggles that we have had in talking about this particular commercialization effort over the last 15 years has been the tension between RIK and RIV. I would love nothing more than to sit here and stay in a position where we're at RIV, where we don't have to take any risk, and all we do is sit back and count the cash coming in when the project starts up. But that does not appear to be a viable option for us. And as we engaged the companies in this discussion, they were pursuing an RIK solution, we were pursuing an RIV solution, and what we have attempted to do is try to make RIK look a little more like RIV so that we're in a position to leverage the producer's expertise in marketing to get the pricing terms that would result in an RIV-like cash flow for the state. Ultimately, we may decide to pursue marketing arrangements that are different, financing arrangements that are different, and other partnerships that reduce our risk, but will probably have some impact on our cash. But it allows the other parties to make their investments and business decisions in a way that allows the project to move forward and realize this potential that Alaskans have been waiting on for 40 years. So there's a number of ways to look at these problems, and I'm looking forward to solving the challenges associated with direct participation. I like puzzles. I like solving puzzles, and it so happens that Commissioner Rodell is actually quite adept at the financial aspects of these kinds of things, and I think we've got a great opportunity here to engage the marketplace where some of these solutions are going to be found.
Follow-up, Reps.
I'm not so big on puzzles, but I like solutions. But I do want to make sure that we are looking at all the puzzle pieces, mm-hmm. that we're not just saying this is the way to go. And I think I heard you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that once we have this agreement, TransCanada is going to go out and get financing. I think that's what it is. So are they better than us? Do they have a better credit rating than us? Because I just asked if we could go out and get financing, and you said you don't want to make you don't want to paint the picture that we could go out and finance this kind of money. Someone's going to be financing it. Mm-hmm. Do they have a better credit rating? I mean, I haven't checked today, but I thought we were pretty good. I don't know what TransCanada is. So someone's got to go get it, and someone's going to reap the benefits of that. are we certain that the percentage of benefits we want to reap? I just want to make sure that we're asking the question. Are we better off? Are we better off taking this on our own? Are we having partners and sharing it? I'm not convinced that we wouldn't be better off, you know, saying it's the four of us doing RFP, which we've done before. TransCanada was the winning bidder on that. They're a very capable pipeline company, and putting it out there again and see what we come up with. I mean, I don't know that that's not the solution, as opposed to just here we go down the road merrily singing. And one thing, and I keep bringing back the treble damages, and I see the profit over based on the previous contract, I see the profits in this outstripping any treble damages we could possibly pay over the course of this project. So are we better off cutting our losses? Are we better off with a partner? Are we better off with this partner? Are we better off with another partner? And those are the issues that I want to see explored. And as I read this memorandum of understanding, it's pretty specific. So those are my questions, and I'd be happy to entertain a meeting to have those answered. I mean, you can do it on the record. Any way you want to do, you can think about it. But those are the questions I have before I jump headlong into an agreement. I want to make sure that, you know, I've been married 33 years, and I married the right lady. If this is going to be a 33-year marriage, we better make sure that we marry the right lady. And that's all I've got. And I don't expect any answers or commentary or anything else, but that's what I'm looking at for the information of the body. Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Okay, I got four questions in the hopper, Tara, then Sadler, then Olson, then Hawker. And then we've only got about four slides left to go, so I'd like to go clean through those slides. We got time left. We'll take questions then. So, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to build on the questions from Representative Johnson, they were some of the same ones I had. And in thinking about those same issues, just wondering, when you consider the state's overall credit rating, at what point, when you're talking about these different alternatives and the, you know, debt-to-equity ratio, at what point do we threaten our good standing now because we've taken on too much debt? Was that part of the consideration in recommending 75-25 and how that would impact, as you mentioned, other important state priorities?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I think there are two different things going on here. I think one is, as Commissioner Balash talked about, is what can we do to push the tariff low and looking at those combinations. But to more to your point, and I think it'll be helpful as we walk through the next couple of slides, is to see the value of having a partner in this that helps with the cash calls and what that benefit is to the state versus the risk. The risk on the rating that you raised is really quite one of, are we going to be able to meet our day-to-day operations as a state? Mm-hmm. So if we take $11 billion and we put it off to the side and we say this is for our equity investment into the pipeline, we make it available for cash calls when and if they're requested, it creates an inability in the state's financial flexibility to meet its daily operations. Whereas if you think of the partnership as the debt issuance that the representative discussed, which is we have an opportunity here to let a partner come up with the financing, and we have an agreement that when the pipe comes into use, we'll start repaying those cash calls and repaying that debt, arguably. And so what is the value of not having to come up with cash over the next 10 years? What does that look like, that repayment stream look like? And that gets reflected in the tariff that's discussed here. Mm-hmm. And if we have an opportunity that we want to use some cash, there is the 40% equity option so that we can step in and actually front up $6 billion rather than $9 billion, or in the 25% equity, $8.6 billion rather than $11.4 billion. So part of it, in this case, was TransCanada's willingness to give us that option to allow us to decide when we get to the end of pre-feed if we want to actually put up 40% at that time, or if we see other reasons to not do that at that time and not take advantage of that option.
Never a good idea to get overextended on your credit card, is it? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Chair. With your indulgence, a little bit informal back and forth to make sure I understand the chart. The far left two, this is State of Alaska ownership of the entire project at a $45 billion cost. Is that, I'm reading it correctly?
Mr. Cochin, that's correct.
Okay, and the middle two, it's TransCanada's ownership only of the pipeline and the treatment facility.
So if you want to think about it, in the far left, there's no TC involvement.
Okay. And this is for the entire project?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And the middle one is?
The middle pair is if TC steps into our shoes for the GTP and pipeline.
100% of the GTP and pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 20 to 25% equity is whose share of?
That would be our share of the liquefaction facility. That would be the capital we would need to provide.
Okay, great. So TransCanada would own 100% of the pipeline and treatment, and the State of Alaska would own 100% of
the LNG plant and associated marine facilities.
And so on the right, it's the same thing. TC owns all of the pipeline and treatment, and the state would also own 100% of LNG, and then the state would buy back to a 40% stake or 40% of?
40% of the midstream. That's the Exhibit B, the equity callback option that we have.
Yeah. It says 40% of the midstream of the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, for clarification, that's the percentage of our ownership of the pipeline.
Correct.
Not
of the 25%.
Of the 25%, not the total. They wouldn't own the pipeline. They'd own 100% of our 25% or whatever it was. So not of the pipeline. So I want to make sure that no one thought that TransCanada was going to own the pipeline, or we were going to own the whole pipeline. So just for clarification. I know you'd have done that, Commissioner.
Okay.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Bailash, I'd like to go back to some of the points that Representative Johnson made. And due to lack of time, I'll just sum it up to one point. We've got 2.5 months left in session. Are you comfortable that by the end of that 2.5 months, we're going to have adequate information to make a rational vote on this, on the enabling legislation?
Yeah.
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I have every confidence in this institution.
And the only reason I asked is because I look around the table and there were at least five of us that were at this rodeo a few years ago. And
I would observe that as an institution, the members here are far more familiar with the ways in which pipelines operate and the ways in which some of these key terms affect the state. And I think the fact that we are further up the learning curve as a state, as a legislature, will enable some of the key decisions to get made for this step. Again, we're not asking anybody to make a 30-year commitment today. We're asking for the ability to progress this through to the next phase and stage and level of commitment by respective parties.
Okay, finally, Rob Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually, as looking at the clock and taking your admonishment, I've really got a lot of questions. I'd like to go down into the overall agreement that gets to even our ability to ask the questions we're asking right now. But at your council, I think we probably ought to let the commissioners complete their presentation, and I hope we have another chance to talk about more details with them in the near future.
And Representative Hogger, we will, no doubt about it. Commissioner, please proceed.
So this is another way on slide 13 to look at the cash call issues for the state. And what you see is in the blue line, the same three scenarios we looked at in the prior slide. The SOA ownership only for blue is the light blue is reflected here, and you see we're solely responsible for the cash calls between now and project startup. And so the line is in the in the red. We're having to meet up until 2018 when project sanction would occur and the big money starts flowing. We see upwards of $1.2, $1.3 billion being required annually at the peak of construction there in 2021. We hit startup and our cash flow suddenly turns positive. And you see that occur when we get to full ramp up in 2023 and a progression of our revenue overall that occurs. And then you see the tail there at 2043. The reason it tapers off like that is we're talking about the proven resource at Prudhoe and Point Thompson. It is our firm belief and expectation that there will be additional gas resources found that will, you know, instead of tapering off there in 2043, continue the trajectory out for many, many years.
Well, this is the most conservative estimate based on known reserves at this time.
This is a highly conservative based on the proven resources at both of those fields, and also in our price deck, we are assuming oil linkage for pricing the LNG, but at $90, which is a fair bit less than we're seeing in the market today.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I might just add, it's important to see that footnote at the bottom, too, that this does not include any additional revenues to the state that this project might produce, such as corporate income tax or property tax to the state. So just to make clear that there are other revenue opportunities to the state that are not included in this graphic.
That's right. We're trying to isolate the revenues that are affected by TC or no TC. Slide 14 is another way of looking at some of the same issues of concern, and in this case, taking into account the opportunity cost of our capital as well. And again, you see these are total cash calls, total cash flows cumulatively, as you look at the three scenarios.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and this just goes back to the question Representative Johnson had about the value of a partner versus doing it ourselves, and I think that you can see how the opportunity of not using our own cash actually benefits the state by having a partner participate.
One of the really important points on slide 15 that we're illustrating is the opportunity for expansions. And what we're illustrating here is both the 20 and 25% equity case, and assuming then that another train is added for liquefaction purposes. Another assumption that needed to be made was that additional train of liquefaction would require an additional train of treatment up at the North Slope, but that the pipeline would be able to expand with compression to achieve that additional throughput. What we see here is that the state's long-term future that I think Representative Johnson was speaking to is incredibly bright when you take into account the opportunity for continued exploration, development, and production of natural gas. And the reason you see the numbers take off in 2045 is because the pipeline is essentially paid off. And that's actually a point that I would observe is in the term sheet and the Exhibit C, what's contemplated is that at the end of the initial contract term, we would have the opportunity to, in essence, buy out TransCanada's interest in the midstream at their net book value. So That's something I'm sure we'll get into in further detail at a later date. And then slide 16 touches on the in-state deliveries. So this is the distance-sensitive rate-making element that I spoke to earlier, and it shows Fairbanks deliveries, which actually would be the Nemana zone, and requiring then a lateral to get from Nemana up to Fairbanks with an overall tariff of $3.70 to get to basically what you would call the city gate in Fairbanks. As you progress then to the right, you see charges to get to South Central, we're assuming the Big Lake zone, and finally to the right, the full haul all the way to the LNG plant itself. You'll notice that the blue component of this bar graph is the same across all cases, and that's for the treatment services. Treatment is required whether you move 1 mile or 100 miles. So that number is the same for all three delivery zones, and it is the green, the pipeline tariff, that varies. Mr. Chairman, we'll just wrap up with the same slide we did on Monday. A shot of Point Thompson with the sun in the background. And we are excited at the opportunity to work together and maintain momentum on this course.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. I'm sure we'll have a number of questions here shortly, but one of the concerns that I think the members of this body, you know, as well as the entire House, we look at this deal and we wonder, given what it would have cost to simply have a divorce with TransCanada from the AGEA process, you know, when you add up the potential treble damages, arbitration, whatever, there's a certain value in that. There's a certain value here in TransCanada's ownership percentage that you've negotiated with the MOU. And I don't know the exact numbers there, but I suspect they're significantly different, higher probably. So I think you've made certainly is a great introduction to exactly the value that TransCanada brings to the table and your justification for making the deal that you did. But I imagine we're going to have to continue this discussion and suss out with specific numbers what exactly the value is that TransCanada is being granted and the justification for that difference between the divorce scenario and the negotiated scenario. So all the reasons that have been presented to me so far certainly make logical sense. I mean, they're good reasons, but you guys will need to continue to justify those reasons to show the value that we're getting for the way we've negotiated this deal. So with that, let's see. Representative Sadler, Representative Hawker, if you'd like to follow up questions, and then Rep. Seaton.
Okay, thanks. Kind of quick technical question. Offtakes in three zones, why three takeoff rates, why versus five takeoff locations? Why not three and three? Why not five and five?
Through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we could identify specifically, those three points, how many offtake points we ultimately have. It could be far more than five. The number of offtake points is something that we'll work to identify, and I think some of the prior work that we've done in the past would show that so long as things are pre-installed during construction, tapping into the line, if you do it up front during construction, is not a very expensive or cumbersome thing to do. And so we may have multiple points that never get used. I hope that's not the case. When you're looking at these distance-sensitive calculations, you know, three seem to make the most sense because these are sort of volumetrically weighted. And so you want to concentrate on the largest likely draws off of the pipeline.
Fair enough. Representative Hawker?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the time we've got left, I'm asking those questions. We have a due diligence responsibility here to say, is this a good deal or not? And I kind of want to get my own head around, this is really kind of a take-or-leave-it deal for us. We don't have a lot of latitude. And I'd say those of us that it was alluded to have been to this rodeo for a dozen times have always had a lot of latitude in the process. Here, you know, we have this necessity for enabling legislation that is specifically spelled out. And in order to exit AGEA, which is necessary to go forward with another project plan here, we have to have both a trigger event and this execution of these things called transition agreements. And a trigger event means the effective date of that enabling legislation, and it actually says that Trans-Alaska Development Inc. finds that legislation acceptable. So that seems to me, with all respect, it's a veto authority on the whole. If we make a change of sufficient merit, and which is probably a material change to the enabling legislation that is pretty well clearly spelled out here, it's legislation that allows you to enter into these exact terms and conditions that you're describing up here, your partner, TransCanada, has the ability to say no, and we just go back to square one. Which seems like, you know, we're just kind of in a, we really are not in a situation here as a legislature where we have much say in the policy development. Just wondering, can you talk, you know, how much latitude, as we look at these components, and you heard questions about debt equity, you heard, you know, questions about ownership percentages and all those sort of things, how much latitude does the legislature have to get into being proscriptive on such things without jeopardizing your agreement under this MOA and then subsequently the flow through to the HOA?
The Chair, Representative Hawker, I think that there's a couple of things to respond to there. In terms of doing your due diligence, we are happy to play whatever role you would like us to play in that due diligence. Your contractors have made it to town. We're doing everything we can to help them understand what we looked at, how we looked at it, so that we're not talking past each other in assumptions and models, and we'll continue to do that. We looked at all of this information in a variety of ways, far more than has been presented here, and we'll be happy to generate whatever information we can. I would ask that we coordinate that through the respective chairman of the committees, but you know, we can present this information in any number of ways, and we can look at various scenarios. With regard to the latitude of the legislature, we fully respect the independence of this body, and again, I would call members' attention to 2.1D. You know, the parties in this case, Commissioner Rodal and myself, along with TransCanada, have agreed to this set of terms, and we have agreed to agree to contracts or transition agreements that look like this. But depending upon the conditions or limitations included in the enabling legislation, they may walk. But, you know, that's a decision that they will make. And it's something that I'm confident the process for developing legislation, there'll be an opportunity for them to review whatever it is the legislature would like them to consider, and they'll have an opportunity to comment on it. That's what these hearings are all about.
To that, I may follow up.
Follow up, Reporter.
To that specific point you made, and we get back to that 2.1 subpara D. And I think the first time we talked about it, it was glanced over because it does say everybody agrees to support everything going forward, but there's a great big word in there with two letters in it called if. And the word following if is a capital P, parties. I just heard, and I think if we re-ran the record here, you say that that applied to the other guys might choose to walk. Capital P, parties, is actually both the administration and the other guys. Was that a commitment from you that no matter what legislation passes here, the administration will stand behind it and put the sole onus for walking away from this on the other guys?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I wouldn't characterize it that way. And whether we're talking about this document or this document, there may be circumstances or conditions or limitations in legislation that's passed by this body where Commissioner Rodell and I are going to need to decide in our respective positions whether we think that the course laid out continues to be in the interest of the state.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I do appreciate that because that's the role. I did not want to hear you abrogating that role. It's entirely possible for us to pass something that you as an administration find an inappropriate reason to go forward with the other guys, and for whatever reason, they might love it. which was very important to me.
Mr. Chairman, that's a very real scenario that we contemplated.
You know, Mr. Chair, I know the clock is hitting 3 o'clock straight up. I'd love to drill down on another area, and it's really about how are we really exiting AGEA in this agreement, or are we really just temporarily suspending it? Mm-hmm. Another time or right now?
We're going to have another chance. The co-chairs and I have talked, and we will have another hearing on this same subject, the MOU, on 12 February.
Okay.
Okay. So for any listening and any in the room, 12 February, we'll deal with this again. In the meantime, that's a lot of opportunity for engagement between the commissioners and their staffs, between the companies and their staffs, TransCanada especially. And, I expect that, Representative Hawker is absolutely right. Whatever we end up deciding, either it falls within the parameters and the boundaries laid out in the MOU and the HOA, or it falls outside those parameters. And if it does fall outside the parameters, I would hope that neither any of the parties would simply walk away, but we would be engaged in further negotiation, as uncertain as that may be. So with that in mind, I ask all committee members to really dig down into the hard legal fine print on these documents. We've got our own lawyers, and please converse with the co-chairs, and if you have specific information or testifiers that you want to hear on this subject or that you think would bring good outside opinions to the conversation, we will certainly work with you guys to bring that to the fore. Representative Seaton, you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to put out on the table so that when we get back together, you can have an explanation. There's a general assumption being made that for the state, we want the lowest possible tariffs. At some point in time, the tariff could be the income stream for the state. There'll be many, with a low tariff, we may be losing the most significant income stream we have, depending upon the price, which would be the in-kind portion. So I would like to get a discussion from the administration for the public of low tariff and what that gives us as future limitations on our ability to have a revenue stream, depending upon the price that we get for royalty and taxes. So I just wanted to put that out so that everybody would be aware. Thanks.
Fair enough. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. Glad we could get this knocked out in a sort of abbreviated schedule. We'll see you next Friday, or this Friday. We're adjourned.